going to finish up Ephesians first. So let's turn our attention to Ephesians. And in particular, let's turn our attention to Ephesians chapter 6. And we're going to begin in verse 10. We're going to read it together. And then we're going to have a word of prayer. And then we're going to dive into this passage of Scripture. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10. And Paul just, he's wrapping things up. So like a good Baptist, he says, finally, and then keeps going. Finally, and I want you to watch the commands that Paul issues in this line. He's been giving it commands all through. And do you remember the last command he gave was walk, walk worthy of the calling by which you have been called. He says, walk together. He's commanding them to walk. And I mentioned that that walk is not an amble through the woods, over the hills and through the woods to grandmother's house we go. It is a military unit marching to combat. And here he's going to describe the battle. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the evil. So be strong for what reason? Be strong to stand. All right? Be strong to stand. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. Now, what makes you able to stand? The armor. The armor is what makes you able to stand. Put on the armor of God that you may be able to stand. I know this sounds crazy, but don't go into battle in your underwear. God prepared us. He gave us some armor to wear when we march to battle, and we should be aware of that. All right? That you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not... notice the word he uses, wrestle. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood. This, by the way, a tiny little kind of allusion to Jacob wrestling with the man of God on the riverbank back in Genesis. He didn't know who he was wrestling with. It turned out he was wrestling with the angel of the Lord. But he says we are wrestling against something bigger than just, right? He says we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against rulers, archi, that's the Greek word, against authorities, all right, ekousia, that's the Greek word there, against the cosmic powers, that's a great word, we're going to come back to the Greek word there, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, pick up, take up, put on the whole armor of God. Little bit of a tiny allusion, by the way, to David in the Hebrew Bible. When David marches out against Goliath, Saul tries to give him his armor, and David says, this isn't the armor for me. I haven't tried this. And what does David says his armor is when he comes up against Goliath? When he comes up against Goliath, Goliath says, am I a dog that you sent? What is this kid? And he says, you come in the name of your God. I come in the name of the Lord. David puts on the armor of the Lord when he marches against Goliath. It's a good piece of advice for us. He says, therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. Real quick, before I get into the text. In the evil day, what have I been saying about in the last few weeks? What is the only thing sufficient for the present moment? Evil. When is the evil day? Against the cosmic powers in the previous verse over this present darkness. This is a battle going on right now. And we need to be aware of that. Take the whole armor that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to do what? To stand firm. At the end of the battle, who will be left standing? The King Ahab, who's got a bunch of problems, he was not a great guy. But Ahab has this great moment in 1 Kings where a Syrian general, they're going to fight a war, a battle. And the Syrian general comes out and starts laughing at Ahab. And Ahab has the single greatest put down in the entire Bible. He says, it's not how good your armor looks like, looks, it's who's left wearing it at the end of the day. And it is a great line. That's buried in Hebrew. It's all like cleaned up and nice and neat in the English translation. That's what he's saying in Hebrew. He says, only the guy wearing the armor at the end of the day has a right to brag. And that's a great line. It's like the person that's standing. So you want to be standing. Stand therefore. And this is the part that everybody focuses on. I'm actually not going to focus on this passage, but I want to hit it. Stand therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and as shoes for your feet, having put on the readiness given by the gospel of peace. In all circumstances, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all the flaming darts of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit. By the way, these are all commands. These are not optional. Take the sword of the take up the helmet of salvation, the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying at all times in the Spirit with all prayer and supplication. To that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all the saints and also for me, that words may be given to me in opening my mouth boldly to proclaim the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, that I may declare it boldly as I ought to speak. Now, we're going to come back to that last piece, but Paul is bringing all of the stuff he said in Ephesians to a head right here in this combat situation. Remember a couple weeks ago when we were reading at the end of Ephesians 4, and Paul says, speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Remember that line? This is what he's talking about. It's, oh, you know, we just get together and say, kumbaya, ya, la, la, dee, 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 sing together, have a great time. He's saying, these are the songs we sing in combat. These are the battle cries that we call to one another, the spiritual songs that we sing. When we sing about the Ancient of Days, we are singing about the one whose banner we march under to war. And we need to understand that. Too much of Christianity has become wimpified and comfortable and easy because we've had a position of advantage in the Western world for a long time. We talk about the Judeo-Christian work ethic. We talk about the United States being founded by people who believed in God we trust. And somebody said that the other day, and I had a time, I'm like, that didn't actually come about till the 20th century, but I get what you're saying. All right, this whole idea that we have God-given rights, all that flows from Christianity. Now, different versions of Christianity, but it all flows from this idea, this Christian idea that we have a position of dominance. Yesterday, Jeff and Bree and Lori and my wife and I and Heather, we went to this conference, and I'm not going to get into too much about it. But a guy asked about blue laws. How many of you remember blue laws? There's still a couple still in the books. Like, it's still illegal to take a bath on Sunday in Boston. I don't know if you know that. All right, blue laws were, you know, and I grew up in a town that literally on Sunday morning, no businesses were open until 12 o'clock and they all closed at 6 on Sunday. You were not, I don't know if you know this, is why you have a big lunch on Sunday. You all go home, like, ever notice that Sunday lunch always tends to be bigger than every, it's because that was the day the restaurants were only open for lunch. You couldn't get to dinner, so you ate a big lunch on Sunday. But now today, things are open all the time. We're talking about Thanksgiving and stuff. But blue laws came about because of the Puritans, who were the dominant force in New England. And every New England town has that one little white church, right? That one big white church downtown. That was the Puritan church. And that was the official church. That was the established church. And you know the First Amendment, it says Congress shall make no law concerning the establishment of religion. You know that the Baptists wanted that in the Constitution. Literally, the Baptists, like our crew, wanted that in the Constitution because we did not want the United States saying everybody must be Congregationalist, Baptist, or Episcopalian. Every town's going to have one church and all the taxes are going to go to it. And the Baptists said, no, we'd rather be poor than be on your payroll. Why don't you just go ahead and make it so the government doesn't do any religious? That's actually the foundation, by the way. First Amendment does not guarantee the separation of church and state. The First Amendment guarantees that the government will not mandate religion. That's what it requires. It doesn't say that the church can't influence the state. Anyway, so getting back into this, so we're in this passage and we're looking at this, and I'm talking about the blue laws, that Christian ethic that was there. As crazy as it sounds, Christianity is the reason that the military you uncover when you go inside, because you never wore a hat in church. And that's where that rule came from. You take your hat off inside. That's where that rule came from. We don't follow that rule anymore. At least Jeff doesn't follow when his hair's growing in. Now that his hair's in, he's taking his hat off, you know. But we've gotten comfortable. And Paul doesn't live in a world where Christianity is comfortable and easy. He lives in a world where he is literally aware every single day that there are forces aligned against him. Now, so Paul turns to this idea of the armor of God. This is not original with Paul, just so you know. Paul did not come up with this metaphor. In fact, this idea of the armor of God is a quote from Isaiah chapter 59. And I want to read to you what Isaiah says the armor of God is. Now listen. The Lord saw it, the corruption of the world, the brokenness of the world, the injustice of the world, and it displeased him because there was no justice. He saw that there was no man and wondered why there was no one to intercede. Then his own arm brought salvation. His righteousness upheld him. He, God, put on righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head. And he put on garments of vengeance for clothing, and he wrapped himself in zeal as a cloak. Paul says God is going to war, and we are marching with him. It's not popular today to talk about a God of war. We like a God of love. And he is a God of love. The crazy thing about God is that God is able to be fully, totally, perfectly Elohe Chesed, the God of loving kindness, and Elohe Michala, the God of war. In fact, one of his titles in the Hebrew Bible is Adonai Tzabaot. Now, we get that translated in English as the Lord of hosts. When I was a kid, that confused me to no end, because a host was that English guy that did Family Feud. It was Bob Barker. So I'm like, is he the God of game shows? Sabaoth is army. He is the Lord Adonai, or Yahweh, of armies. God, and lest you think that I'm overreaching, by the way, the God of the New Testament and the God of the Old Testament is a God of war. You say, no, the God of the New Testament is a God of love and compassion and mercy and understanding. Really? Then I saw the heavens open, and behold, a white horse. And the one sitting on it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness, Batzadek in Hebrew, the characteristic rightness of him, he judges and makes war. The God of the Hebrew Bible is a God at war. But here's the thing, he's not at war with you. That's where we get wrong. When we start talking about God being a God of war, we think he's at war with us. He is not at war with us. He is at war with the powers, the authorities, the cosmic creatures, the spiritual beings that are using the sin in our world to warp and destroy and confuse and break down what he desires to redeem. Paul says to us, we are to be equipped, right? Let's go back to verse 12. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against rulers, Greek word is archi, Our key is generally a ruler. When, if you remember, when Jesus heals the child of a ruler of the synagogue, that word, our key. Our key is usually translated in English as ruler or prince or something like that. It literally means first one. By the way, the Roman emperor called himself the first citizen. That may be an allusion to that. But then he says authorities, exousia. Exousia is someone who has delegated power. So a ruler is someone who has power innate to their position. Exousia, authority, is something you give to someone. When Jesus sends the disciples out in the book of Matthew, at the end of Matthew 28, he says, all authority is given unto me in heaven and earth. He says, I have received all authority from my Father, and I'm giving it to you to go forth and be my disciple, make disciples and of all nations. So at that point, we could kind of say, okay, these are earthly things, right? Rulers, authorities. And Paul was dealing with that, right? He's in jail, right? He's in prison because he opposed things. People are like, well, he's in prison because he broke the law. He didn't break any law. He just preached that Jesus was the resurrected Son of God. That was the problem. That was, and the Romans had no idea what to do with him. They were just shuffling him off, just transporting him, having him interview with a bunch of people. But then he brings up this, the Greek word is kosmokrator. This word is really tough. It's the only place it appears in the Bible. So it's called a hapax legomena. That's a Latin word for it. This is the only place it appears in the Bible. But it does appear often with archi and exousia in the rabbinical literature, in the Jewish literature, and every place that it appears there, it is about not earthly rulers, but supernatural powers that are aligned against Adonai Tzavaot. See, Paul eases us into this idea of we're going into war. He says, but we're not here to fight the Romans. The Romans are under someone's authority. We're not here to fight Caesar. Caesar is under someone's authority. There are powers in this world. And this is so, so important. People ask me sometimes about spiritual warfare. It is so important that you understand this. There are powers in this world, and you are not strong enough to fight them by yourself. Everybody's like, I'm going to be a spiritual warrior. I'm going to go out and be a spiritual hero. Good luck with that. That is like bringing a water gun to an atomic war. That is like the Polish, in World War II, the Polish riding out against the German panzers with spears on horses. You going up against the powers of this world that we can't even perceive. We don't even know for sure what they look like, sound like, can do. We don't walk around. I mean, anytime this, somebody said, how do you spot a false teacher? If a false teacher goes, I identify a spirit in this person, a spirit, I'm already skeptical. You somehow, some Gnostic power that you can identify these spirits. Now, when the Bible identifies them, by the way, the Bible identifies them in certain ways. You can always be guaranteed anytime, this is a side note, anytime in the scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, anytime God declares something cursed, like, you know, when he talks to Abraham and he says, I will bless those that bless you and I will curse those that curse you. You know what God's saying? He only curses things that are under the power of these other forces. He declares a curse on them. By the way, he declares a curse on them that they might see him and his chesed and his justice and come to faith. That's why that curse is there. It's not, God's not, oh, well, he's going to curse them, you know. The curse is there to draw their attention. And Paul actually applies that in 1 Corinthians. He's dealing with somebody in sin in the church. He says, put them out of the church, put them under the power of Satan, that they might be restored. That they might see they need God. Right? So the Lord of armies, he is lined up. We are the army. We are part of the army. Now, I was told in an anonymous email, and this person may be preaching, may be listening online, that I used too many military metaphors a couple weeks ago when I preached about a passage where the Apostle Paul uses military metaphors. I'm going to go ahead and stick with Paul. He's using a military metaphor here. He is describing us marching into battle. Not as a solo hero. I love the movie Gladiator. It is totally made up. The Romans did not fight the way they're fighting at the beginning of that movie. Looks awesome, so cool. The things that we do in this life echo in the next, all that stuff. Romans didn't fight like that. Romans did not fire, you know, if you've ever seen Gladiator, it opens with this, they're in this battle in Germany, right? And they're catapulting balls of flame over trees, and they lead a cavalry charge. And they're all in stirrups, which the stirrup wasn't used in combat until the medieval period. That's the historian in me freaking out. The kings are all running. Commodus, if you've seen the movie, I don't want to ruin the movie for you, but it's 30 years old, and they've already made a terrible sequel. There's this final battle where Maximus, you know, Russell Crowe's character, he fights Commodus, Joaquin Phoenix character in the Gladiator. And actually, Commodus was stabbed to death in a bathtub. Somehow, I think Ridley Scott was not going for that look. But we tend to think of ourselves as the hero standing up. If we're going to be spiritual warriors, if we're going to use our spiritual gifts, we're going to stand up and we're going to fight. Let me tell you something. Paul understood that you don't go mano a mano against forces that are aligned against the eternal God. You don't decide you're going to throw down with Satan because even, and I'm sorry if this offends you, even if you can say, in the name of Jesus, that is not enough. In fact, in the book of Acts, somebody tries to cast out some demons. And what does the demon say to him? The demon says, Jesus, I know. Paul, I know. Who you? Right? We don't go on this. Paul gives us the template for dealing with an enemy we can't understand and we can't fight on our own. And what is the template he gives us? The template he gives us is the Roman army and Roman soldiers did not fight alone. I despise, and I don't use language that very, very often, I despise the model of Christianity that elevates the individual above the community that God instituted. Jesus gave ordinances and authority to. Now, yes, the church, big C, has abused its power. Certain denominations are out of control, and some of them are trying to lead people out of the freedom of the church under their hierarchies again. There's a massive movement to try to draw people out of the freedom of salvation and into, you've got to be a part of our church. You will never hear me say that, by the way. You will never hear one of our elders say, the only way to be saved is to be part of our church, our brand, our idea. That's not what, guys, salvation isn't even limited to the church. You know that, right? All right? This is a whole other sermon. I'm going to put this up. But those of Israel who have taken Jesus as their Messiah, who are not yet of the church, because the final church in Hebrews chapter 12, the assembly of the firstborn, when we all come together at the mountain of God, that's yet to be, but they're still followers of Christ. You get that, right? You can be a follower of Christ, all right? So there's a lot to this. And you can be a follower of Christ outside of the institutional church, that can be. Our version of the church, let me rephrase that. There is no salvation out of our limited model of the church. How's that? The way that we think the church is structured, we find the church is much bigger than that. Roman soldiers that Paul would have been very familiar with, because at one point he was chained to a Roman centurion, and there's a shipwreck. I love the conversation. Can't get off of this. Paul was one of those guys. You just sit there and go, could anything worse happen to this guy? Like he's chained to a Roman soldier on his way to be tried before Caesar. He gets stuck in a storm and he says, "Hey, unchain me. The boat's going down." And the soldier goes, "Are you sure?" Paul's like, "For crying out loud, would you please undo the handcuff?" right, where am I going to go? Right? We're in the middle of the Mediterranean, for crying out loud. All right. But anyway, the Roman soldiers, he understood about Roman soldiers. I have this feeling that Paul actually knew Roman soldiers very well, because I don't know if you know this, but when Paul says that he was a tent maker, do you know that tent makers were employed by the Roman government to make tents for Roman soldiers? That was their job. That's what he was. So he probably grew up around Roman soldiers. He grew up around this world. He understood it. And he knew this about Roman soldiers. Roman soldiers do not fight alone, and their equipment is useless on one-on-one combat. It is useless in one-on-one combat. And they did that on purpose. The Roman military structure was designed because the Romans fought for one thing and one thing alone. Senatus, populesque, Romanus. The Senate and the people of Rome. They served one power, one force, and they fought together to preserve that thing. And Paul says, as the church, we have one head, one Lord, one Father, one baptism. He goes through all that in Ephesians 4. Why does he say one, 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 one? Because Christians love to round out ahead of the formation and fight on our own and then scream and cry about how everybody's not supporting us. Pastors are particularly bad at this. Here I go. Hey, come join me with the Holy Spirit. I'm the one with the Holy Spirit. And everybody else is like, you know, why are you running out there? And I'm not going to get into the armor, but all of this armor, the function of this armor, the Roman soldiers, the way that they used armor, the idea was armor was defensive so you could be offensive. Their design, the way they fought, was to basically protect each other as they moved forward. You had a big huge shield that you held in front of you with your left arm. There were no right-handed Romans or left-handed Romans. All right. You held this big shield that basically ran from ankle to above your head. You held it in front of you, and in your right hand, you held a very thin spear that the whole function was to stab. And the guys behind you held their shields up above your head, and they had longer spears that they stabbed. And the purpose was that we all go in this together. We all fight together. And now I'm going to go back to Gladiator, because there's this moment in Gladiator where he says, as one. Because as a Roman soldier, he knows you don't fight on your own. You fight together. Then ironically, he fights on his own at the end of the movie, which blew it for me. He should have brought in a Roman legion. That was the way it should work. The church does not fight. And here's the deal. This is where I think we get things wrong. We think the church stands together for the individual. The church is all going to huddle around every single person and make sure they're protected. You are best protected by the community of Christ when you are on the offensive with the rest of us. You say, well, I feel all alone. Get in formation. I feel unprotected because the shield that's supposed to protect you is the person you're not willing to let protect you. Husbands and wives. Paul deals with marriage last week. And I appreciate all the positive feedback. I really thought I was going to get some crazy stuff from last week. But last week, talking about marriage, husbands and wives, you need to realize you are each other and your children's shields. And kids, you need to realize that you are your parents' shield. And parents, you are your kids' shield. And you need to move together. We need to fight together because, and I hate to keep beating this, but I want to make it clear, the enemy we are fighting is not you, and it's also not, you are not its equal. So we have to be submitted to the one who is greater. I love the passage in Isaiah that I read. When the Lord looks around and goes, nobody else can do this. Now, he already knew that. But Isaiah presents this to the people of Israel as, God looked around and said, nobody else can do this. And so he took his own shield and he put on his own breastplate and he marched to war. And he said, you come with me and I'll protect you when you're with me. And I would rather march with God as the commander out front. By the way, and this is a side, that's why the incarnation is so important. Forget the theology of he had to be one of us and all that stuff. God shows us that he's in the front lines. He's not sitting in the back, go, minions forth. Which, by the way, is how Roman emperors led. And then they claim the victory. I did all this conquest. Look at me. I have a really complicated Latin name. But it was the centurions, it was the soldiers, it was the people who were marching that expanded the Roman Empire. And Paul looks at them, he says, look, he says, we as the church, we are called to walk together to the battlefield, withstand together the attacks of a power that is greater than us, and then to stand. Wherever he tells us to go, we stand. I just finished. Well, I'm taking my wife through Band of Brothers, because I mentioned in the sermon. And there's a moment in Band of Brothers, they're in Holland at Einhold, and the flank falls apart because Tiger tanks show up. And there's a colonel, and he's sitting there with his head, his glasses, like, and his aide says to him, or the sergeant major says to him, he says, hey, he says, Fox Company and Echo Company are falling back. And he turns, he goes, well, who told them to do that? Right, as tanks are bombarding them. Like, and you sit there, well, we're called to fight together. We're called to rise together. We're called to stand together by someone who can see the battlefield. We can't see it. We can't see the enemy. We can only stand together. And unfortunately, the isolation that we experience as Christians in a world where it's all about me, it's all about the individual, it's all about how I feel, it's all about what I want to do, it's all about my spiritual gifts, it's all about my... When we live in that world, we are going to get beat down. Now, it takes a certain measure of humility to recognize that sometimes some of us are the people that are going to be on the front holding the shield in front. Some of us are going to be the guys with shield in the back. Some of us are going to be the cavalry. We're going back to Gladiator. Cavalry waiting in the woods, even though that never happened. We're going to have different functions in that army, but we've got to work together. You say, I don't like this idea of being an army. Isn't it better? Wouldn't it be better if you know, for example, wouldn't it be better if we just sought intellectual consent to the ideas of Christianity? How's that been working for us? Wouldn't it be better if we emphasized, and again, there's nothing wrong with, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with theology, but wouldn't it be better if we made sure we had plenty of seminary-educated people to be able to teach us great, deep doctrine? And there's value in that. We have several seminary-educated people in our church, and they're very valuable. But that's a function in the army. That's not the only thing the army is supposed to be doing. Because the Lord has put on the breastplate of righteousness. His strong arm has gone forth to the salvation of all creation. And we are called to march with him, to walk with him, to walk together with him, in step with one another, protecting one another, to go into war with forces that we cannot understand. So we have to be, here it comes, the bad word, submitted to him. Well, I'm not getting what I need. Every time I say that to myself, and trust me, I say that. Again, going back to yesterday, I was in a room with a bunch of people that were freer in their worship than me. There were people dancing. There were people holding hands. There were a couple of people somehow worshiping by taking selfies. Unsure about that one. There were people blowing shofarim. There were people dancing a lot. And I am standing there. I am not doing this. In fact, I have my eyes turned down. I'm looking at the ground because I know that if I start to judge all those people by my standard, I'm asking them to join my army instead of marching with Christ's. The church does not fight alone. Let me end with this. Seriously. Uh-huh. Not you, Siri. She doesn't answer when I ask her stuff. And she certainly can't spell or use commas anymore. Middle of sermon, she's on it. That's why I don't wear my Apple Watch anymore, by the way. Where was I going? Oh. As a part of the church, you need to know this. You do not bear your trauma alone. We all carry it. We have a responsibility before our Father to bear one another's burdens. Not one another's convenient burdens, all their burdens. Husbands and wives, you look at your spouse and you say, well, she is out of control or irredeemable or nuts or whatever word you're using that particular day. Because let's be honest, our internal monologue can be a little crazy. That's why every man should wait to 10 before he utters a word to his wife. Unless the word begins with, I love you, and ends there. Or starts with, you are amazing, and ends there. Don't qualify it, guys. This is an aside. Whenever my wife waits for her, she goes, and? But you forgot to clear the dishes. Just, guys, take a breath. Say the first sentence. Leave the rest off. Don't say the things that pop in your head. It's never good. All right? In fact, crib notes are a good idea. You are amazing. I love you. You're the love of my life. I will never do anything to upset you ever. All right? But my point is, you bear those burdens together. We need to be able to deal with our issues, our sin, our trauma, our brokenness, our struggles, our questions, our deepest, darkest thoughts. The church is supposed to march together. And when the church is the place you are least likely to share the greatest burdens, that's a problem. Because we need to march together because the enemy is bigger than all of us. Just how big? I guess you have to go to the podcast. Let's have a word of prayer. Adonai Sabaoth, Lord of armies, you have redeemed us, called us, and gifted us to march in your ranks. In the world we live in, controlled by powers and authorities and false gods and spiritual forces, has broken and corrupted and destroyed parts of us, so we sometimes feel incomplete, broken, shattered, unable to go forward. We believe that you have surrounded us with brothers and sisters to shield us, to carry us, and for us to carry them, for us to rise to the challenge, not of conquest, but of protection, of defense, of declaration of your supremacy and power. You have taken up the breastplate of righteousness. You have taken up your sword. Your strong right arm goes forward. Help us to march with you. And when the enemy is bigger than we can handle, when the darkness encroaches and we are unable to hold it back, may the man and the woman beside us and before us be the conduit of your grace and strength and compassion and power, that we might continue to stand. May we stand for one another. May we stand in protection of those who are broken by our world. And not in judgment, and not in division. May the world look at us and see hope and joy and truth and love. May they see the restoration of a broken world through the power of its Creator, who has come to lead the army. May they see you in us. And may we purge whatever it is in us that shows any other power. We pray this in your precious and holy name. Go in peace, my brothers and sisters, and be the church of Jesus Christ.